It's Thursday, May 2nd, 2019. It's 11:12 in the morning. This is your Mincing Rascals, named Best Podcast by the Chicago Headline Club last May, and the presumptive repeat winner of Best Podcast when the prizes are handed out a week from Friday. And I am your presumptuous guest host, Eric Zorn of the Tribune, filling in this week for the vacationing John Williams, who's about to be Wally Pipped.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of The Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
And I am Eric Rung. I'm a reporter at WGN Television as well as an anchor here at 720
and
WGN.
And now back to Wally Pipp.
You guys got the Wally Pipp reference, right?
We did get it, yeah.
Everyone knows Wally Pipp. Eric might not have
because he's under 50, I think.
Right, I don't get the reference.
1925, Wally Pipp was the starting first baseman for the New York Yankees, and he had a headache one day, so they put a kid named Lou Gehrig into the lineup.
Oh.
And Pipp never started another game at first base again, so we're going to see what happens with John and hosting this podcast today. We're going to run over some. We're going to just hit a couple of topics. The first topic I want to talk about is blackface. Photos and video posted to social media last weekend showed a small group of white Homewood Flossmoor High School students riding around in a car wearing blackface makeup and joking around. This sparked a walkout protest at the school, which is 70% black. Demand that the students be expelled. Blackface is racist and offensive. There's no question about that, but it's not illegal. Should a public school be able to expel students for performing an offensive but legal act off campus? Steve Bertrand.
I didn't read the full story, but were they also accused of saying derogatory things about African American girls?
They were accused of making fun of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, which I think is a big mitigating factor here, but
mitigating or aggravating?
Aggravating. I'm sorry. You're right. This might be unpopular, but I just don't feel that schools. I don't know when it became the fact that schools are responsible for punishment of young people 24/7. I mean, I see inside the school building, I see at sporting events, but I don't think that they should be punishing students for what they do outside of school. And I don't think they should be held responsible for it, too, either, because the schools are in an unfair situation on this, too.
Right. I mean, it's legal to wear blackface.
It's not defensible.
It's not defensible, but it is legal. It is speech. It's offensive speech. Eric, what are you?
I've heard, Steve, you make this argument over the past week here in the newsroom as well, and I tend to agree with you here because it wasn't on school grounds. Now, if it happened on school grounds, absolutely.
Much different.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, they should have say in the punishment. Off school grounds, I mean, that goes back to parenting, I think.
But how about that? I mean, it does seem now that schools are responsible for punishing kids,
part of it, though, social media, right? I mean, part of it is that social media, it bleeds over into so much other stuff that the line between what's in school and what's out of school gets blurred by Instagram and Facebook.
I think that's part of it.
Twitter.
I also think it probably started earlier when there were real crackdowns on high school drinking. And they started extending, you know, the punishment that way. So if you were in sports and you were seen in it with a red cup or something, you know, no matter what time of day or where it was, we could take you out of all extracurricular. I mean, I think that's when the punishment sort of, or the response, the duty of schools or responsibility of schools started expanding.
Yeah, of course. But of course, sports is not a right. Like public education is a right.
I understand that. But I think, and it's a chicken or egg thing, but I think it probably started with the idea of cracking down on drinking.
Yeah,
with the code of conduct.
Right,
I mean, that's
right.
Where it all came from, for sure. I remember when I was in high school, I had to sign a document saying that I would not drink at any off-campus parties or anything like that. Absolutely. That's
right.
Where it came from.
Yeah. Of course, drinking is illegal for high school students. I mean, I know it's not.
You keep going back to blackface not being illegal.
I do, because I mean, if these kids had robbed a bank or something like that, or had done something illegal, it's a deplorable thing, and it's interesting to me that blackface is becoming
an
issue in 2019.
Right.
But it does seem to me that this is, obviously, it's a teaching moment for the school, but there's a significant protest down there where people are demanding that they be expelled, demanding that they be, I'm sure they've been outed. I'm sure everybody kind of knows who
they
are.
Oh, absolutely. They already know who they are. And they already have security at the school, too.
And so my guess is those boys can never go back to that school. That would be.
Oh, I don't know. Have you reported on it? Are they going to go back to the school?
Yeah, they're back
yeah,
at school.
I think they'll go back.
And they have security, according to other students at that school.
You know,
that was reported.
It's clearly another teaching moment for the
school. What if they had been, and this is illegal, what if they had been convicted or busted for shoplifting?
The thing is illegal. No, I know. But
do you kick them out of school?
But no, I think you don't. I mean, I think that shoplifting is clearly a minor.
What if they also were riding in the car wearing a swastika on their shirt?
Well,
or
yeah.
Something like that.
Again,
it's not illegal.
It's not illegal, but, you know.
Indefensible.
This is public education. You want to kick them out of a private school, yeah. But,
right.
I mean, kicking them out of a public school, I think there are other remedies. I mean, I guess I'm kind of with Steve. It's like, at what point does this become the school's business when you're doing something like that off school grounds?
And I kind of feel sorry for the schools because becomes their responsibility, and I don't think it should be.
When I was thinking about this topic this morning, I was thinking, well, how would I feel if I'm like the principal of the school right now or the head of the school board having to make a decision like this? I think you would lose in court if you expelled these kids for this.
I don't think they'd be expelled. I don't think they could expel them.
There's a call for them.
There's also
this, you know, and this comes up with, we talked about this a little bit, and I got a lot of angry mail about the AJ Friend case, but I think we in the media make these stories bigger than they are, and not that it isn't a significant event at this high school, but I think sometimes we don't allow for the fact that 15-year-olds are doing stupid things. You know, and this was a case of 15-year-olds or 16-year-olds doing some really stupid things that need to be dealt with, punished, taught, but not necessarily made into a world-changing event.
I would agree with this kind of thing. I don't know how old these boys are. Actually, I don't know their ages either.
I want to say sophomores, but I'm not sure.
Guessing.
That.
I mean, and it's clearly at this point.
Well, someone was driving.
Immature, and stupid, and probably racist. Racist act.
I have a hard time believing that teenagers don't know that blackface is bad
by now. Yes,
by now.
Absolutely.
I mean,
with all the coverage this year,
exactly, especially with the governor of Virginia. I mean, it's all over the news.
And you know how 16-year-olds watch
the news. Yeah, but I also think people do. That's why you ended up here, Eric.
I know.
Here with two has-beens talking about the news. I know of a person who, when he was that age, it's not me, scrawled something bigoted on a garage door. And he is the least bigoted person I know. I mean, absolutely, you know, can attest to this guy's character, but he was 15 and he was stupid and he did it, and I know he regrets it still. So I mean, I think there has to be some allowance for that too.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that too, and which is why, you know, the school's role in this seems to me to be one of you know, making it a teaching moment for the other students, and in also for the kids who did this. Like I said, I'm skeptical these kids can actually go back and reintegrate, so to speak, with the school population these circumstances.
And I think the school's role, too, is to, you know, allow these protests to vent and to speak and to voice their concerns as well.
Yeah, which they did. Let's move on and talk about the inauguration. Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot is asking local companies to pony up from between $25,000 and $100,000 to help pay for her May 20th inaugural festivities at the Wind Trust Arena. And my question is, really? If corporations have that kind of money lying around, why not ask them to use it to fund educational or recreational opportunities in disadvantaged neighborhoods? Yes, lavish inaugurals are an American political tradition, but why not signal a new, more humble approach with a simple swearing in ceremony at City Hall, followed by a rolling up of the sleeves and getting to work.
Well, I mean, that's a beautiful fantasy world that we would be living in if that was going to happen, but that's just not going to happen.
Well, I feel like, if in the case it would be Lori Lightfoot's.
But I don't know. I mean, again, it does go back to the political tradition of the inauguration, and I think it's hard because that would be great, but it's not going to happen. It's not.
Yeah, I don't know any examples. The last one I could think of was J.B. Pritzker, who had his huge inaugural thing.
He had Maroon 5 or something.
He paid for the whole thing. So, you know, and Lightfoot is obviously not in a position to pay for the whole thing. Trump's inaugural was kind of a bust, right? He had bands that were less prominent than Maroon 5, certainly. I can't remember. Was it Up With People? Something like that.
I remember covering Richard M. Daley's first inauguration, which was at the Lyric No, not the Lyric. It was at Symphony Center, I believe, because we were perched in a balcony. So that, you know, that was very ornate. I think they got less and less so as he kept winning and winning.
I would think so. I mean, the first inaugural, maybe a little bit of fuss, but the second one, I don't even remember.
It's like a marriage, right? The first one's big. The second one, you know, don't even register.
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know about that. It just struck me when I was seeing that she was out, you know, shaking the cup for $25,000 to $100,000 from the local. And what's a company going to say, right? A local company's going to say, "No, mayor-elect, we're not." So they're in an awkward position, and so it really has this odor of politics as usual.
It does seem like an odd way for her to start.
It does, you know. I mean, I would
agree with you that if there was going to be a change, it would be with her. But at the same time, this is. It's also a big start for the city too, because of her background and where she came from and how she won this election too.
Yeah, it seems like maybe the second inaugural ought to be the one where you celebrate your accomplishments or something like that.
I just want to go to some of the socialist aldermen's inaugural parties. I think those are going to be fun.
I don't think they're going to. Yeah, right. a lot of fun. Another thing that happened locally was the graduated income tax. Illinois moved a step closer to making the rich pay more this week when Senate Democrats advanced a proposal to amend the Constitution to allow for a graduated income tax. The proposal still needs supermajority support in the House and from voters in 2020 if it's to become law, which, damn it, it should. Graduated or progressive income taxes, in which you pay a higher percentage the more you earn, is good enough for the federal government and for 34 states. Republicans are warning that allowing for multiple rates will only make it easier down the line to hike taxes on the middle class, but Democrats make a better case when they say our current flat rate, in which billionaires like J.B. Pritzker pay the same rate as the guy who drives the truck that delivers new toilets to his mansions.
Or takes the old ones out.
The guy who moves them around.
Right.
It's a protection racket for the ultra wealthy. So should we soak the rich?
I'd rather not. Yeah, we should soak the rich. I'd rather they move the income levels up a little bit. I'd be a little more comfortable there.
Wow. You want to look at the tables, you can see how Bertrand's clearly doing. Right.
It wouldn't matter to me either way where the levels are. But, it just seems like it's hard to defend not having a progressive tax system. I mean, for everybody to pay the same thing, no matter where you're at, it's hard to listen to the defense, I guess.
Yeah, the argument again is always, well, if they make these multiple rates, then what they can do is they can, instead of, right now the situation is the state income tax is 4.95%. And they fight over this, and it was 3 a while back, and then it was up to 4.95. Then under Rauner, I think it was down to 3.75. They moved it back down again. But they have to move it all. Moving it all at once, you have everybody is feeling the pain or feeling the benefits when you move the rate. This way, it allows you to say, okay, well, we're going to take people who earn over $1 million, and they're the ones who are really going to get soaked in this new plan. And we're going to tax them. And we're going to give everybody else a really modest cut. I think if you make under 250, you get a really tiny
reduction.
Or maybe under 100, you get a tiny reduction, like $50 or something like that. But the argument is that it makes it easier to do that. But I don't think in practice, if you look around the country, look around states, that it actually works that way. That politicians find it particularly easy to say, okay, now we're going to raise taxes on the middle class.
Usually a pretty good campaign slogan, right?
Well, that's
raise taxes on the middle class, right?
But that's not. But I don't think this is what the Republicans are warning about. But I don't think there's any evidence that that's what happens.
Yeah.
And I do think that it is fair. It is. They call it the fair tax, but I think that it does. You have to raise the money from somewhere. People say we got to cut. Well, yeah, we have to have an efficient state government, but it's not like there's a ton of waste in state government right now where you can say, like, oh, this program is. I mean, they have gone through successive. I mean, Rauner had years and Quinn. All these people were trying to cut the low-hanging fruit off the budget. They really don't have a lot of programs that aren't involved in public safety and health.
Well, is it going to pass? I mean, I know it's gotten through the Senate, but do we think it's going to get through the House?
I have read conflicting things about that. I heard that the House feels comfortable that they're going to get it through. The Democrats have a supermajority. It passed in the state Senate on strictly Democratic votes. But then there's also talk that maybe the Democrats don't have the votes, so that there's some downstate Democrats who don't like this idea, who are feeling the threat of the idea that this is a tax increase on quote unquote everybody, which it
and they isn't. Don't have to open up the Constitution to do this, right? They can just change it by referendum. change the con. They'll amend the Constitution.
That's what they're voting on, right?
Right. They're voting to amend the Constitution.
They are voting. Well, in a, I mean, it's a multi-stage process. You have to get it through the General Assembly. The governor actually does not have a voice in this because it requires supermajorities in both chambers to get. And all it calls for then is to put that question on the ballot. To say, okay, we're going to ask the voters, and then the voters, 60% of the voters have to approve it. So it's not, nothing actually happens in terms of your taxes until November 2020, when, if this all goes the way the Democrats want, you would have that part of the state constitution is amended and allows for graduated rates.
But I guess what I'm asking, Eric, is we talk about the having to open up the Constitution, a constitutional convention to change pensions.
No,
right.
No,
so why is
No. You don't have to have a constitutional convention
to change pensions.
You have to amend the Constitution.
A
constitutional convention would be where everyone gets together and we're going to throw the entire document out the window and start again. And
we could change the pension rule along the same way we're changing the tax
without opening it. No, there's there's a lot of talk. Certainly, our editorial board wants them to say, hook these together like a pension. You know, there's a pension protection clause in the Constitution, and our editorial board is among the people who are saying, like, well, what we ought to do is we ought to have a ballot proposal to take the pension protection clause out of the Constitution. That ain't going to happen. Just, you know, spoiler alert. But that the Democrats are never going to allow that.
Well, I would sign up for that.
There's also a proposal to change the way political maps are drawn. That would I think they would have to add that to the Constitution.
I mean, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here because
not
of the
on this podcast.
Matter.
You don't.
I mean, I don't
first
understand
timer.
how. I guess I do understand. Again, I would be living in a fantasy world if I believed that it'd be like, okay, well, this is the fair way to do it. Let's have computer draw the lines for the congressional districts, and then we'll go from there. It's the fairest way to do it, and it's just beyond me that can't get done.
Yeah, well, the line that I find very persuasive is, you know, that right now we have a situation not where the voters choose their politicians, but where the politicians get to choose their
voters. Absolutely,
which is unconscionable, and the idea that you're drawing lines in order to, you know, maximize the support of one party. Yeah, I think there are fine ways to look at what the partisan balance is in a state, and to try to draw the map so that your overall results will reflect that partisan balance. So that if you have, say, a state that's, I think our state is like 55% basically Democratic, then you're going to have 55% of the state lawmakers in both chambers as close as you can. You know, you're never going to get that perfect, but that should be the goal. But you have states, and the only problem that I have really with Illinois doing it unilaterally is that if we do it unilaterally, then I want Texas and North Carolina and some of these states that Republicans have gerrymandered
for members of Congress.
All the map drawing is done for at every level.
I know, but
should be a federal law that you have to do it that way.
I would hope so.
What is what Texas does have to do with what we do, well, other than members of the congressional makeup?
Because the members of congressional thing, and also because when you have these states that are dominated by, you have a state that it's like where the voters are like 52% Republican and the state houses are 70% Republican. I mean, that's not fair. And the kinds of laws that they end up passing and the representation they get in Congress because of that ends up skewing all kinds of votes. And so if one state does it unilaterally, I mean, I totally take Eric's point, but I also think that this needs to be done on a federal level, that there ought to be a federal law about this, because state by state, why should Illinois Democrats unilaterally disarm? Say, oh, we're going to be good guys.
But how are they disarming? I don't get that. I mean, other than members of Congress.
Members of Congress.
That's what you're talking about, the congressional makeup.
And then you could also lose control, but it's unlikely right now, but you could lose control of the General Assembly. And then you would have a situation where then the laws and tax policies in Illinois would be turned over to Republicans.
But if they did lose the General Assembly because the maps were drawn fairly, would be a fair loss.
That would be fair, yes.
Right.
It would be fair.
It wouldn't be fun.
It would be fair in Illinois, but it would you know, if you look at it from the sort of the fact that we are United States and we have various laws and that cross state lines and don't cross state lines, that you want to have your party have some power. I mean, this is like Mike Madigan's been all about for so long, which is keeping control of his majority.
Maybe. Gerrymandering has, I think, been one of the biggest downfalls of our
well, there was a benefit
country for
to
a
it.
Long
there,
time.
There was a benefit to it when they tried to fix the gerrymandering, right? That's where we got, when they went into courts to because the early gerrymandering was limiting minority voting, right? And,
right.
Then we went into the courts and fixed that, but it's now gone askew the other way.
It's a really, actually a very interesting and complicated problem to how to do exactly what I'm talking about while still giving your, because the Voting Rights Act requires you to have districts that are, I think, it's not just 50% minority, but it's like 60% in order to assure, say, Hispanic or an African American representative.
I just think we have the technology now. We could put an algorithm in and we could figure that out, and then you have very fairly drawn maps.
What would we do with all the back rooms? The back rooms would be empty.
Well, there'd be no smoke in them. But you know, I mean, Eric is right. We have this technology, but we haven't even gotten to the point of addressing what the problem is, because we're still like saying, no.
Maybe Bill Barr could start to look at this because he's done with everything else.
He has done with everything else. Let's talk a little bit let's have our last topic be William Barr, the so-called attorney general. I think he sold his soul to the devil, Donald Trump, on Wednesday's appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Sounded like Trump's personal attorney, not the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. Outside of the Fox News bubble, his reputation is in tatters. Should he be impeached?
Well, I think he certainly, well, everyone now has performed impeachable events or actions. So, sure he should be impeached. I mean, he lied to the Congress. It's pretty clear that he lied to the Congress. For all the crap that's happened in the past 2 years, two plus years, I think the William Barr episode, when it came to his misrepresenting the report and now misrepresenting the Mueller letter before the Congress, has been the most discouraging, the most dismaying, because, you know, Trump will do what Trump does, whatever. But I really thought that if Barr or the Attorney General of the United States wasn't going to step up and perform his or her role, I thought at least he wouldn't make it worse.
He's made it worse. He was supposed to be one of the bumpers along the side of the bowling alley, right?
Right.
He was going to keep this.
He was friends with Mueller for two decades and had all the, you know, had been in positions of power before and had done the right thing.
In the Bush administration, the moderate Republican Bush administration.
He basically said that, right, he testified this week that if the president of the United States is under investigation and the president thinks it's an unfair investigation, that he's within his rights to end the investigation.
And instruct people to lie
and to end
the investigation.
And he said that if you were going to, suggesting to Don McGahn that you get rid of Mueller was not firing him, because he was getting rid of him for some, you know,
because of conflict
of interest.
Cooked up conflict. Yeah. I mean, it was, I thought it was just a disgraceful performance by him.
And I think Comey said yesterday something to the effect, when you work for Trump, that it just slowly eats away your soul.
Was that the Washington Post editor? And it came out right when Barr was looking for his soul.
But so what do Democrats do? Because the president clearly should be impeached.
The
president clearly has done things for which he should be impeached.
Yes.
But I don't think it's wise for the Democrats to impeach him.
And why is that?
Because if the Democrats want to gain in the 2020 election, I think they're better off not being embroiled in impeachment. I just think they are. They are better off without it. But I also think it's their duty to impeach him, because what he did was clearly greatly wrong, and they should act to remove him from office. But I just don't think it would be politically smart to do so.
I agree with you, Steve. I mean, I think everybody kind of knows the story and knows that, yes, these are all impeachable offenses, and yes, they should be impeached, but not to get bogged down in that. I think that would hurt the Democrats in 2020.
And you know, when we say the word impeachable, it sounds like, well, we've reached the minimum. Well, yeah, we can do it now. This is impeachable. But the fact is, this is way beyond the minimum line. I mean, what he did, I would love to see Mueller questioned before Congress and ask the question, if Donald Trump were a real estate investor, would you have indicted him? I don't think Mueller would answer that question directly, but I think if he did, it would be yes. And I would love to see
that. It was really interesting how Barr characterized his letter as snitty.
Snitty,
which is an interesting adjective. I was going to use that for my introduction.
And that struck me, too, because he was asked, you know, in the previous hearings, if he was aware of Mueller being upset with him or disagreeing with him, and he said no. And then, you know, in this year, and this week he sort of said, well, you know, he didn't really disagree. And then he described the letter as snitty.
And I asked him if he felt that my letter was misleading or inaccurate. And he said, no, that the press, he felt that the press coverage was, this letter was an extraordinary act, a career prosecutor rebuking the Attorney General of the United States, memorializing in writing, right? I know of no other instance of that happening. The letter's a bit snitty, and I think it was probably written by one of his staff people.
Well, how can you not disagree and write a snitty letter?
And it was written by, probably a staff member.
His underlings,
yeah. I would like to hear Mueller talk about that, because I'll bet it was not. That was an important letter that he wrote. Well, you know, arguing against impeachment, first of all, it's not popular. The polls that I've seen show that the public is only, like, somewhere in the 30s, the public and the public doesn't like Donald Trump,
right,
but only about 36-37% of the public wants this guy impeached. That's one argument. The other one, and the other argument is that at impeachment effort, impeachment is simply a verdict that's sent over, or an indictment, basically.
Yeah.
It's bound to fail.
In the Senate.
No
Without Republicans on board, that ain't going to happen.
No, there's a lot of Republicans on board. No way is it going to happen. So it is a sort of a suicide mission, but it's a performative act. Those are arguments against it, but I agree with Steve. I think that this is a duty of the Democrats. This is why we have impeachment. This is why the founders have this in the Constitution. When something like this happens and there is no remedy in the justice system for these kinds of acts, this is what they have to do. It may hurt them politically. I'm not sure that it will. I mean, there's certainly...
You don't think it would?
I don't think so. I mean, people talk about what happened in 98 to the Republicans. The Republicans won the White House in the year 2000. They've hung on to Congress most of the time. They hung on to their Senate majority. It wasn't a bloodbath for Republicans. And that was to my mind, that was a much finer, bigger reach. Because basically he was lying about a sexual encounter, and they wanted him removed from office for that. This is a whole. I mean, there's a bill of particulars about the obstruction of justice that go on and on with Trump. And
so you're saying that the Democrats should go on the suicide mission?
I think they should. I mean, a suicide mission in that particular thing is not going to work. I'm not sure that they would be suicidal in that, in the sense I'm not sure that they would end up dead, but I think that there is enough that needs to come out that could still come out.
For the integrity, is what you're saying, right?
A catch, because, you know, the Democrats spend so much time saying the Republicans should stand up and do what's right for the country, and if you're going to live by that standard, the Democrats should impeach this president.
Yeah. So you guys have newscasts to do coming up. I don't have anything to do this afternoon, so I'm just going to go and hang out by the spa over the Tribune offices.
Nice.
But let's do our 30 seconds of whatever you want to say to end out the podcast.
All right. I've been watching this TV show. I usually do TV shows because I just do. But there's a show called Huge in France, and it's on Netflix, and it's this comedian, Gad Emula is his name, G-A-D. And he really is known as the Jerry Seinfeld of France. And he's in this series where he's got an estranged wife and a 15-year-old son in L.A. So it's a fish-out-of-water series. He goes back to L.A. to try to get a relationship with his son. So it's kind of funny because here's this European thrust into the world of plastic surgery and, you know, shallow people. So it's funny on that front. But then the other is that he keeps going up to people saying, no, I'm really big in France.
And he's showing
videos and everyone goes, yeah, it's France. We don't care. He really has a great presence on the show.
Is this like a documentary?
No. It's a series.
So it's all fictional.
It's all fiction.
He's not actually.
And some of the fiction, some of the side characters are over the top. But this guy, Gad, I could watch forever. He's really good on screen, and it's a funny show.
This is not my recommendation, but I would tell people to go on to YouTube and look up for Michael Smith's song, Famous in France.
A friend who is famous in France, though he's not quite that well known over here.
Oh, okay.
Hilarious. So Michael Smith is a local treasure. So anyway,
I'm going to go with the television show too. This was on Netflix. It's Russian Dolls. I don't know if you haven't heard about this. It takes place in New York City. It's about this woman who continually dies and comes back to life.
Wow.
In the same predicament that she was in. And she, at first, she's kind of going through it, trying to figure out why this is happening. And then she meets somebody else that's going through the exact same thing. And the weird thing is, time is continuing. And the way they show this is by fruit starting to rot and fish dying in their bowls and things like that. And they have to try and unravel the mystery behind why they keep coming back to life.
Russian Dolls.
Russian Dolls.
Check that out.
I'll tell you, it's a little bit of a, it's a really cerebral variation on Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
That movie. Right. And it's only, what, 6 or 7 episodes. So,
oh, you've seen it
so
then.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
No, it's brilliant. Yeah, yeah. I love it. And it's, so it's manageable. It's not like, you know, go watch Game of Thrones. Like, oh no, 6 seasons. I can't do it. But, anyway, new favorite social media feed is called Obvious Plant. It's the brainchild of comedian Jeff Wysaski. Creates product parodies, actual product parodies, and places them on store shelves and then posts photographs of them. For instance, there's a bottled beverage labeled Human Tears. Enjoy the salty goodness of suffering. Ben and Jerry's Barely Any Glass Ice Cream. Let's Look at the Sun Precision Binoculars. And the Funeral Kazoo. Drowns out sobs and wails better than bagpipes. Sorry for your loss.
Oh, that's funny.
They're better than those old wacky packages stickers.
Right.
They're funnier and weirder. So search for Obvious Plant. Eric Rung from WGN TV, thank you for coming in.
Absolutely.
And
thanks for having me.
You're much, much better than Scott Stanis.
Much better.
And Steve Bertrand, and I'm Eric Zorn, and we will have a podcast for you a week from today.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.